At the present time, we are most analytical. And looking around us in society, we are likely to be over-influenced by surfaces and fail to recognize that beneath these surfaces, the large, deep stream of human value flows comparatively undisturbed. Just as the individual may be perturbed by some incident that occurs, yet after the passing of this incident, returns to his own more normal standard of values. The same is true with the world. And perhaps there is nothing, no subject, that gives us greater insight into the values which man holds to be important and real than the folklore or fairy tale or legend. First of all, these legends and fables, stories, are of great antiquity. They do not relate to the passing moods of times. They come up to us from a depth. Therefore, they give us a means of measuring depth. And this is of constant value and of continuous inspiration to us, because depth is always richer than we are inclined to suspect. As we go through the fairy tale and legend value in literature, we not only find the universality of certain essential plots, so that we can trace the plots of the Brothers Grimm or Hans Christian Andersen back through nearly all of the cultural life of our race. We find that the primitive Egyptian, the ancient Chinese, the old Hindu, all of these peoples enriched their culture with mythological accounts, legends, and folklore. Not only do we therefore find this stream pouring out of antiquity, but we also observe man's instinctive and inevitable reaction to these stories. Actually, man will not preserve, sustain, or remember long that which he cannot associate with his own psychic life. If, therefore, he comes upon some account that is invalid as far as he is concerned, he will neither perpetuate it nor regard it with favor. From these basic points, it appears then that the continual affection that we bestow upon ancient legendary and the continuation that we have made of the essential formulas in modern literature, particularly fiction, these indicate our natural tendency. For example, in modern motion pictures, we know that all things being considered equal, the audience will require a happy ending. It will require some conclusion that is acceptable. And where we have a strong departure from this, we have a dramatic experiment which depends for its survival upon certain other values, which we will also mention. But all in all, the simple human formula is still the most successful in theater, in literature, and in motion picture and television. This again brings up the question, how did we gradually move from the familiar happy ending of past ages to the rather dismal realism which we like to feel represents the thinking of today? Perhaps the answer lies in a gradual motion in the last 50 to 100 years away from an essential pattern in the human psychic organism. For thousands of years, man has been subconsciously dependent upon religious inspiration. In emergency, the tremendous structure of the world's religious tradition comes to the assistance of the harassed or disturbed person. And during those long centuries in which our legendary and folklore developed, it developed in an atmosphere of essential devotion. The individual was primarily dependent upon spiritual value for his personal orientation. Spiritual value essentially stated the victory of good over evil, the victory of faith over fear, and that the virtues practiced in daily living must inevitably, in the end, have their due reward, whether in this world or in a better world beyond. Thus, essentially, through this whole long period of more than 5,000 years of recorded history, man's great refuge was his faith, was his sincere belief in the reality of a universal good, the reality of a benign, paternal, or parental force at the root of life. As the religious life of ancient man was considerably simpler than ours, there was very little creedal confusion. Until the Reformation, there was practically no general creedal confusion in Christendom that affected the life of the average person. There were various schisms within the body of the faith, but these were limited mostly to intellectual classes, minorities. The great body of religion moved serenely in the small town and in the village, where the people built their homes and gathered in the square facing the church. And here their lives were centered, polarized, around a strong concept of a benign world. Also, the average person at that time was not widely traveled, nor did he come in contact with intellectual stress. He lived simply, thought simply, and carried the daily burden of life. Therefore, your fairy tale, your story, your legend of this nature nearly always builds around simple things. Average persons, everyday situations, dramatizing to a degree that which was familiar to all, and which each person could intimately associate with his own personal daily experience. There gradually arose against what we might term the romance literature of the medieval world the rise of what we like to think of today as the humanistic literature. Perhaps the most powerful instrument, as from a literary standpoint, to point up man's disillusionment was the Spanish story by Cervantes of Don Quixote de la Mancha. Here we have this old knight living, dreaming, existing in a world of fable, discovering through a series of experiences that his dream world had no existence, that he was really a madman trying to restore a kind of life that had long departed from among us. After the story of Don Quixote, the increasing pressure of material things began to influence man's subconscious life. He began to develop the plot without the happy ending. And to the degree that religion in him was weakened by the pressure of externals, and he was subjected more and more to the pressures of material disillusionments, losing his simple, abiding, internal availability of faith, As this process gradually developed in society, we observed the definite change in the so-called romance story. We see the individual accepting more and more the tragic ending. He could not accept this and would not accept it did he not experience it. The tremendous pressures that developed after the Reformation in Europe, the Hundred Years' War, all of these situations, the French Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars, and finally the drift toward the scientific approach to life, these began to make inroads into the psychological life of the individual. We may say, however, that nearly all of these inroads, as the term suggests, constituted pressures from the outside. The individual, by nature an optimist, by nature addicted to idealism, began to experience more and more the physical frustration of his own ideals. He began to see or realize that he was living in a society which, as it involved greater complexity, began to lose its essential landmarks. Man was no longer able to observe around him the happy ending. He was no longer able to dominate the confusion of his environment. And this, of course, represents our state today, in which the individual becomes more and more of the conviction of his own helplessness, his inability to steer the ship of his own destiny, his increasing recognition, or at least assumption, that he is the victim of the world in which he lives. Thus, a new kind of realism imposes itself upon idealism. Idealism is pushed backward. Man still knows that it is essentially right. Man is still inwardly convinced that the way of good is the good way. Yet he is unable to demonstrate this through experiences in daily conduct. His neighbors are no longer friendly. He can no longer trust his associates. He wants to trust them, but he finds increasing difficulty. And most desperate of all, of course, he finds that he can no longer trust himself. He is no longer able to feel, as he retires for the night with simple prayer, that he has lived a good day, that he has done the things that he should do, that he has made some valid contribution to the happiness or security or well-being of those around him. These consolations, these natural rewards, are less and less obvious to him. Under such conditions, it is inevitable that conflict should arise in his own nature. And under the pressure of this conflict, that he should gradually take the attitude that the fairy story, the legend, and the good fable belong to children who have not as yet experienced the pressure of so-called maturity. Yet at the same time, whenever we dramatize or make a motion picture of some old fairy story, the adult audience is larger than the child audience. We all want to believe it. We all want to see good victorious. We want to see evil discomfited. We want to continue to live by the ancient code of our religion, namely, that in the end, before the power of good, all knees shall bow, and that sometime we shall have a golden age of peace and happiness upon the earth. These are our natural dreams, and these are still the dreams that most normally flow from our own preconscious state, or rise up from the unconscious background or underground of our living. Against this, we are building a strong intellectual pressure. This intellectual pressure of disillusionment essentially belongs to our mental life. It is our mental life that is no longer able to sustain our emotional life. And the average person today is under a heavy conflict between his mind and his instincts, between his thoughts and his impulses, between his reason and his intuition. This inconsistency gradually develops more and more intellectual validity. We are able to see every day proof of the tyranny of circumstances over persons. Yet we are rather reluctant to accept this proof. We question it. We want to doubt it. We want to try, if possible, to continue to hold the child dream, or preserve what the Chinese philosopher Mencius called the child heart. The child heart we have discovered in our daily living to be a tremendous source of strength, whereas this intellectual doubt that rises within us is not a source of strength. It is a source of division. It is a source of weakness. It takes from us the power of personal incentive. It makes us weary, fatigues us, and by disillusionment deprives us of our vitality. We therefore observe that idealism is vital, dynamic, whereas what we term realism is not vital, and it is static. It weakens and does not strengthen. It impoverishes and does not enrich. So we are struggling in ourselves against what appears to be the fact of materialism and the illusion of ideality. Yet man, because actually his various springboards, his motivations do come essentially from inside, refuses to completely give up or completely deny that which inwardly he knows to be necessary and good. Perhaps this is the reason why all great cycles of materialism, as recorded in history, have ended in the restoration of idealism. There is something stronger than the reasoning faculties, and this something is man's intuitive perception of good, his unwillingness to reject a beautiful reality as he knows it inwardly to be, for a less beautiful and less inspiring factuality as he sees around him in life. Thus we see the gradual shift. Intellectually, man is prepared to cope with tragedy. Internally, emotionally, he prefers to function on the level of romantic story. As a result, however, of the rise of a powerful intellectualism, which now more or less dominates social motion, we have the so-called philosophy of disillusionment. This philosophy is intellectually sustainable. Yet even as we sustain it, it injures us. Even as we affirm it, we prove ourselves to be impoverished by it. Consequently, it cannot become the dominant reality for us. If, therefore, we look around us in art, in music, and in all the various cultures that we now maintain, and we observe this gradual drifting towards intellectual materialism, we see it with misgiving. We do not joyously go forth to meet it. And each generation, watching the future, becomes a little anxious, a little disturbed by this drift away from value, because upon our idealism is suspended, or from it is suspended, our entire ethical and cultural life. If our idealism should be actually undermined, should be positively disturbed, then nearly everything that is important to us, it will be adversely affected. Considering the materialistic or realistic approach, observing its works, and particularly noting its lack of perspective into the future, we have become anxious lest something of this nature take over, depriving us of much and giving us little, taking much more than it can give, because it has so little to offer above the level of creature comfort, which the individual has long recognized to be insufficient. Thus, the story of our folklore and legendary reveals our firm foundation upon idealism, and that this idealism is still so strong in us as a group, as a collective body, that we still rejoice in this type of literature, select it, perpetuate it, and still regard it as a rich heritage, and continually attempt to use it in the education and unfoldment of the child mind of the generation. The children naturally are inclined to this type of romantic literature, has also been observed, and that it is the conflict between this romantic literature and so-called factuality that has led the modern psychologist to recommend that children no longer be given this material. It is simply because the ideal brings them into such violent conflict with the factual. The psychologist, the educator, the minister, these individuals do not say that these stories are wrong. They do not say that the moral of the fairy tale is bad. They tell us, however, that the effect of an idealistic literature upon the minds of individuals who are not going to live in that kind of a world may prove to be dangerous. Now, why do we not live in the kind of a world in which idealism can have some fair and proper degree of expression? That is a large question. But man is concerned today more with adjusting with circumstances than he is altering the shape of circumstances. Rather than to attempt through a united effort to build something of a more positive nature, he is content to continue this program of compromise with negation. What perhaps neither the psychologist nor the educator realizes is the tremendous availability of idealism if it was cultivated, directed, made available to the average life of the person. If he had any opportunity, any chance, any means, the average person would shift his foundations onto an ideological basis. It is that he is afraid to do so, or has been educated out of the desirability of doing so. Out of the 2.5 billion human beings that now populate this earth, actually it is doubtful if 1% is devoutly materialistic. Many have had materialism forced upon them by systems, and I think a good example of that would be your so-called Iron Curtain countries. Behind the Iron Curtain, we do not have a solid materialism. We have a materialistic indoctrination attempting to force itself upon masses of people. But left to their own devices, even today, 95% of those persons would return to an idealistic way of life. It is not their desire. It is a pressure which individually they have no means of withstanding. Now, on this side of the Iron Curtain, the situation is the same. Instead of having a strong political pressure working upon us, we have a strong psychological economic pressure working upon us. This pressure is forcing us also to attitudes and codes and ways of conduct which do not please us. And a great deal of our psychological disturbance is due to the fact that we are continually required to do things we do not believe. and to live according to standards that are not satisfactory to ourselves. The individual who is no longer able to respect his own conduct has weakened himself tremendously. So on this foundation, the fairy story becomes a tremendous psychological document. And we can break most of these stories down into two general patterns. These patterns represent the anima story, of which Cinderella is one of the most outstanding examples, and the animus story, which perhaps is best exemplified for the story of Jack and the Beanstalk. These two stories represent the psychological polarities of a situation that we all recognize and all face. We know that within the human being there is a psychic integration. And one school of psychological research has termed this psychic integration the anima-animus focus. The anima focus is the psychic feminine focus. The animus, the psychic male focus. These two psychic foci within our consciousness are responsible for a very large part of our psychological literature, of which there is nothing more obvious than the fairy story, which becomes almost, if not completely, a dream story. Actually, if a person dreamed the Cinderella story, either as a participant or as an observer, we could psychologically interpret that person almost immediately. We would know exactly the kind of problem that besets him. We know the kind of situation that has arisen in the life of that person. The mere fact that this story is not necessarily an individual account, but is a collective which has arisen in the body of society and which continues to influence very strongly, does not change the interpretation. It merely makes the interpretation collective rather than individual. If the collective had rejected the story, had considered this story no longer of interest, had failed to perpetuate it, had not clothed it in 1,000 versions and preserved it through 5,000 years of history, we might say that it is all incidental. But the folk consciousness of the race is merely a collective, personal, psychic entity. And what it preserves and what it accepts and what it rejects, these tell the story of itself and cannot be denied by any thoughtful, observing person. In these stories, then, we have simplified versions of the age of chivalry. We have, again, legends derived from the cycle of Charlemagne and Roland. We have the Indian fables. We have the Persian legendary and lore, and the old Chinese accounts as they are preserved to us in the Red Chamber collection and other ancient sources. In Arabia, of course, the Arabian Nights Entertainment conveys the same essential pattern. Now, in almost all fairy stories, it is necessary for one element to appear, an element without which most of the things that seem desirable to us are unobtainable, and that is magic. A fairy story must nearly always involve some form of supernatural agency, a supernatural intervention. It may frequently involve a polarized supernatural agency, one seeking for good and one attempting to advance evil. There is not only the good fairy, but the old witch. There is not only the kindly old teacher, there is the sorcerer. And there is also some way in which magical attributes are frequently imposed upon the hero or the heroine. So the fairy story differs from sober romance in the introduction of a supernatural factor. This supernatural factor usually involves the protection of some person from impending disaster. Or, if it is a negative kind of story, it subjects the individual to the tyranny of magic, of the sorcery of some other person. This sorcery must ultimately be counteracted by good sorcery. And as the magician and the sorcerer lock in their eternal struggle, we can go back to the primitive tribes of Africa. We can go back to the most aboriginal peoples of our own hemisphere, or of the South Pacific, or of Middle Asia. And we will find there human life at the mercy of the struggling powers of good and evil. Everywhere, the same essential pattern holds. But in the fairy story, it is essential that the power of good shall be victorious, that all shall come out well, and the hero or the heroine shall come to the final good which they desire. The struggle of magic is very interesting because it arises from one of our oldest instincts and one of the most flexible energies which we possess within our own consciousness. Paracelsus was quite true when he pointed out that the great agent of magic is imagination. Imagination is available to all of us. Imagination is a magic power within ourselves. It is the power by which we can inwardly transform values, that we can wave a wand of thought, and by so doing, and by the stimulation of the emotional power of imagination, we can create worlds, we can change patterns, and we can fashion a universe according to our heart's desire. All these things can be accomplished internally. So imagination is the ever-available agent of magic. Imagination, it makes possible to us not only this transformation within ourselves, but also, through its extension into society, many forms of progress, growth, the improvement of things. For actually, all growth, all improvement on the level of consciousness, or in the example of conscious beings, depends upon a certain internal imagery by which something desirable is first envisioned and then gradually brought to reality through art and science. So our magic factor is the power of the dream in ourselves. Primitive man knew this, and he also suddenly came to realize that imagination was more than merely a magic of internal frustration or the creation of an internal life. Imagination had something to do with facts. There was something about imagination that could change mice into horses and pumpkins into royal coaches. And that was the problem that primitive man sought to understand. And perhaps he did better with it than we have. He discovered that there is within man also a polarized magician. There is the good magician who takes upon himself the attributes of the counselor. He is the Merlin. Merlin the magician was a grave and wise old man whose magical powers arose from his virtue, from his traditional age, from his long experience. And this good magician, Merlin, was bound to the court of the kings of Britain. and became the protector of young Arthur, who was, of course, the hero self. So Merlin was one kind of a magician, representing imagination strengthened by the wisdom of the ages, gaining its authority from the deepest and most powerful of our positive ideals. Imagination then grew not merely of itself, but of experience beyond our common experience. And it is said that when reality came into existence as a material or factual thing, when men no longer believed in magic, Merlin went to sleep in a house of glass. Imagination gradually failed in man, and he lost this primitive power to change things, particularly the primitive power to change himself, and by changing himself, change everything else. So we have the magician, and now as opposed to the scientist. Now, a scientist is a good practical man who does perfectly wonderful things in bottles and on blackboards with very complicated groups of figures. The scientist is the new magician. He has his own kind of imagination. But he is opposed to the Merlin, the conjurer, the strange and mysterious wonder worker of the ancient fairy lore. This modern magician places his entire emphasis upon the power of the world as magic to change man. Merlin, however, believed in man, the magician, changing the world. One, the materialist or the realist, feels that man must become ultimately adjusted to his society. Imagination, however, recommends that man remember that he can always be master of society and that it can ultimately be changed to meet his requirements. So the magician, possessing this power of imagination, discovers that as he uses it, he is able to make new values appear, that he can make the dead rise, that he can make the sick well, that he can perform many services, and like the good knight errants of long ago, he can ride forth in his silver armor, rescuing the eternal damsel in distress. This distressed damsel being, of course, his own anima, or his own soul, that is the sufferer from all the confusion of personal life. The power of imagination is not only its fantastic factor, but the fact that perhaps through imagination more than in any other way, man is able to experience truth. The things that man imagines may be more real than the products of his intellectual procedures. If he imagines beauty, he is nearer to the truth than when he rationalizes deformity. When he recognizes the power of good or the power of self over circumstance, he is nearer to the truth than when he recognizes evil and the power of circumstances over him. Yet imagination can become morbid, and under the morbid imagining, all good things can be destroyed. And the evil magician, recognized under such fabulous forms as Klingsor in the legend of Parsifal, thereby becomes the perverter, the misuser of the creative power of imagery. Negative imagination can take a world and make it all bad. Negative imagination can fill us with doubts and surround us with suspicions. Negative imagination can make everything seem to be terrible. And negative imagination can cause us to be continually the victim of evil or of conditions which perhaps have no existence apart from imagination. Yet if held in imagination long enough, will make such deformity in our own character that we will bring upon ourselves the very things that we have previously invented. Thus, negative imagination becomes a power of evil and is the black magician, the sorcerer, the necromancer, the one who deals with the dead and whose machinations are found in spells written upon the road or drawn upon the earth at crossroads by an old cemetery. All these things are also psychological. And today we are beginning to recognize that our own lives depend very largely upon the discrimination we use, the energy we apply, and the devout idealism with which we direct our own imaginative powers. The old Hindu classic has a term which covers the thinking rather well, namely that nothing is either good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. Therefore, thinking perhaps becomes our magician, our black magician, whereas dreaming and hoping becomes our white magician, the power which is continually striving after good, striving after the realization of that which is beautiful and true. Now, it seems to us, of course, that it would be quite impossible for us to wave a wand and cause a mango tree to grow, or cause a boy to climb up a rope and disappear in the air. Yet whether we know it or not, our own magic is far more powerful and far more immediate and far more frequently applied than in the case of these so-called illusions of conjuring. Actually, our own imagination can take a perfectly good life and wreck it. Our own imagination can take a useful situation and destroy it. Our own imagination can not only destroy our peace of mind, but destroy our sanity. It can take us and twist us into such incongruous and incredible situations that it is relatively impossible for us to extricate ourselves. And yet beneath all of this tangled confusion and disorder, there may be a comparative absence of facts. We all live in a magic world. And the power of this magic depends very largely upon what pressure we are responding to. Whether we are accepting the ancient traditional pattern of the beautiful legend, or whether we have become so indoctrinated with realistic literature that we are predisposed to believe that the unhappy ending is inevitably necessary. These things are of believing, not of the fact. And all magic is of believing. And no human being is without beliefs. And the most devout of all believers may be the unbeliever, who has come to a dynamic state of negative acceptances. These things always appear in your folklore. For man discovered long ago that there was another world, a world that is available to him through daydreams, through imagination, and through the devout integration of himself around some principle, which perhaps not obviously demonstrable, is still necessary to his own security. The individual who has lost his dream has lost all. And it is his duty to restore his dream if he wishes to restore a proper, balanced way of life. Here, then, is another element of our fairy tale. Now, in the case of Cinderella, we do have, of course, another factor that applies and appeals strongly to human nature. There is in each of us a curious sense of loneliness, of isolation. There is a tremendous frustration relating to value. Whether we wish to admit it or not, we all feel like stepchildren of the infinite at some time or other. Perhaps we are not this way continuously, but when problems arise, we nearly always visualize ourselves as victims.